Okay, so it's ready for our main event here. So at this time, please join me in welcoming Paul H. from San Luis Obispo as our main speaker.
You may not even need this thing. For those that know I'm loud. And those that have hearing aids, you can probably turn them down a little bit. Anyway, I wore a suit or a tie. I got a tie. My wife picked it out for me. She picked my shirt out for me. She picked my jacket out. It's kind of like being a little kid again. If you've been married for a long period of time, they dress you. She didn't want me to be embarrassed. And I'm proud of her. That's my little wife down here. She looks like a movie star. She just had that cataract surgery. So if you see her with sunglasses, it's because of that. We're going through the aging process. And some of the people in this room will relate. Everything that used to work, you get up every morning, you do kind of a check to see what's broke. Wasn't broke last night when I went to bed, but it is this morning. And you're like, how could that have happened? I was just laying here minding my own business. And, extracurricular activities? What doctor's appointment do I have today? What one do I have? You know, I have a calendar at home and it's like planning out. We're going to go to this doctor, then we're going to go there, then we're going to do this, and then we'll have lunch. And anyway, quite different. Long-term sobriety. To separate the wheat from the chaff, as it were, how many people in this room have between 1 and 5 years of sobriety? Okay. I'm not going to talk to you guys tonight because you guys are just going to go to a meeting every day and not drink in between meetings. So how many people in this room have over 20 years of sobriety? Okay. I'm not going to tell you guys anything you don't already know, but the group I'm really worried about is how many have 5 to 20 years. Let's see those hands. You guys are in trouble. You guys are in a lot of trouble. Because what's happened is you've figured out how to not drink long term. You got that down pat. I don't drink under any circumstances. And you've probably put some things together. Maybe you got a job. Maybe you got a little partner in your life. Maybe you started a little business. You bought a new car for the first time. Maybe you're buying a house. And suddenly this life that AA's given you, suddenly you get busy. And maybe you cut back on your meetings. And maybe you go to more Zoom meetings. Oh, I can go to Zoom instead of that. And then something happens. You go on a long trip. And you can't find an AA meeting on your 3-week trip across America. I'm here to tell you there's an app. Okay? There's an app. You can get on your phone, little blue square, white chair. And I've traveled all over the United States, and in the old days, I traveled with a Western States Directory and an Eastern States Directory. It was little books that AA put out, and you had to call the GSR that was listed for that group, and I learned you always had to call two people to get two sets of directions. Alkies give lousy directions, and we hide our meetings. But now you have this app. And the app goes to a map, and the map tells you how to get to the meeting, and there's no excuse for it. But when you're between 5 and 15, 20 years, you're busy. You got a lot going on. And AA kind of goes by the wayside. And suddenly you're looking around one day, and you don't have a sponsor, and you don't have a core group of people you're hanging out with. You haven't been to a meeting in a long time. And suddenly, you know, I've been doing pretty good for a couple years, maybe 2-3, I'm fine. And then what happens, and I had this happen about 15 years ago. I'm sitting in a meeting at the Alano Club in San Luis Obispo, and a lady comes in. She lived up in Cambria, and she had 40 years of sobriety, and she was taking a newcomer chip. So watch it close. Watch this thing really close. This thing's patient. This thing hides in the bushes and waits for you to forget who you are. That's my advice. Anyway, I was ashamed of myself when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Guys, I like numbers and stuff like that. I wandered into this leper colony sometime in January or February of 1981. And I've been sitting here ever since. I don't smoke dope, I don't eat pills, and I don't drink alcohol. And I do that because you guys taught me that that's the way I was going to need to run the rest of my life. So I come, what happened for me is I just went into a blackout on the 27th of December of 1980 and came to on some Monday in January or February of 81. I have no idea. I didn't know you guys were going to give out chips and make it a big deal and clap and cake and all that. And so what happened for me is I got up that morning just like I had done for many, many years, and I just got loaded. Because that's what I did, and I wandered down to a little Vietnamese grocery store about three blocks off of Wall Street in Salt Lake City, and I bought a six-pack of beer, and I wandered out onto the corner, and if you know people like us, we drink out of brown paper sacks, and that's what I did, is I put my beer in a brown paper sack so when the cops drive by, they don't know what you're doing. Ludicrous. So I had about two beers down. And the thought came to me that frightened me. And it frightened me more than anything else I've ever experienced. And now 42 years later, I can still recall that fright. And this is what it was, is I'm gonna grow old, 30 years is gonna go by, and nothing's gonna be different. That's it. It was as simple as that. I knew nothing about alcoholism other than in college in 1974, on October, I believe it's 28th. And the reason I know that is when I got sober, I still had the notebook. I took a drug and alcohol abuse class from a man named Dr. Glibetti. And in that class, I took a note. And the note was, in Mr. Glibetti's opinion, that Alcoholics Anonymous worked better than any other treatment he knew of for alcoholism. But I don't have alcoholism. I'm a youthful drug abuser, and I'm going to grow out of this. This is just a phase. Now you flash forward to 1981, and I'm standing on a street corner, and I realize I drink. I had never really noticed, you know, that drinking was part of my life. It was just what I did every day. I got up every, and I did it for 10 years. I took my first drink about 2 months before my 15th or 16th birthday. And for the next 10 years, that's what I did. I got up every morning and I drank, or I put stuff in my arms, or I ate a handful of pills. I just thought that was the way you were supposed to conduct yourself. And all the people around me. It wasn't until after I got sober that I really began to do an inventory, because you taught me to, of the men and women that were my heroes, drinking and using. And I had a guy named Dale Smith. He put a gun in his mouth at age 21. He blew his brains out. I had a guy that was my real hero, named Jimmy Turner. And Jimmy was a Harley Davidson motorcycle mechanic that lived behind me in Tuscaloosa. And Jimmy was my buddy. I liked this guy. He taught me about reel-to-reel tapes. Every time I needed to get high, I'd go back to his house. He helped me rebuild a Sportster, and he died with a hot shot of heroin in his arm a few years later. You know, and I look back on the people. Reggie McEwen went to jail for 10 years. Another guy went to jail for 15. I got a buddy named Doug Martin, and he's missing a kidney because he has a car wreck because he's drunk. And it wasn't until I got sober and I began looking at the men and the women that I had hung around with. Tommy Peppers stabbed to death in a bar. I began to do this thing and going, man, the people I'm hanging out with are dying. They're dying. And you can't put the label alcoholism, but they're dying as a result of their lifestyle and their behaviors. And so I thought to myself, you know, I got to get a new set of friends. And that's what I got. You know, the good news for you folks is that we're your new best friends. And that's also the bad news, is we're your new best friends. We really are. Your life is going to depend on the relationships you build in this fellowship. It really is. It's going to come down to that. 2 o'clock in the morning, when you're on fire, your life has exploded, everything's gone, and you don't know what to do next, it's going to be the people you have in your phone that you've spent that time with. So I go to my first meeting of alcohol. Oh, first I want to tell you about central office. I call central office, and there's a lady named Earlene that's there at that central office, 33 years sober, and she talks to me for a few minutes, and she gives me a couple pieces of information. She says, you should go to group 2 tonight on South Temple at about 8:30. She says you should try to not drink between now and then, and then she told me you should get there early. And I didn't know that that was the trick. That was the trick. I thought getting there early was important. So what happened to me is that night, and the curtain kind of went down, and I don't remember the rest of the day. And that night, I wandered into group two. And I got there about quarter after eight. And back then, the meetings were an hour and a half. And I sit down in a room. We have tables. And I get back against the wall, and I'm sitting down. There's an old couple next to me. And I had the good fortune to sit next to a man named Ed and his wife named Venna. And this is the important part. They got sober in 1940 in New York City. They regularly attended meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I got there that night, they were ready. Some of you guys know what a water heater is and how it functions, and basically you have a gas water heater, and it's full of water, and you light a pilot light, and when that water is demanded, when you turn the hot on, then what happens is the flame comes up, because it's already pre-lit, and it begins to heat that water that's already hot and keep it constantly flowing. And I was taught that Alcoholics Anonymous is a lot like that. You come in here and we help each other get our pilot lights lit. And you stay in fit spiritual condition, and now you're ready. Because you may be the only big book that somebody ever sees. And you need to be ready for your 5 minutes, for your 10, for your whatever. And I sat down there that night, and Ed and Venna had been getting ready. I don't know what they'd been doing for 41 years other than getting ready for me. Because I sat down, and Ed said, "You're new." And I said, "Yes." He says, "Let me get you a cup of coffee," which is a clever ploy. Because what happened is he went and he got coffee, and now he sits back down, but he sits down over here. So Ben is over here, and I'm here. And for the next 15 minutes, go to a meeting, get a big book. Don't drink in between meetings. You should get a sponsor. You should go to 12 and 12 every week. You should get go to a big book study. You should do this. You should do that. Go to the Alano Club. That's all I heard. And well, apparently, and then the other thing is they told me to not drink and go to a meeting on Tuesday night. There. Meeting starts. It's an hour and a half. There's a guy named Barney. And Barney's the secretary. And he introduces himself as an Alateen member. Everybody laughs. I have no idea what's going on. There's a little guy in there, his name's Doc, and Doc's got a pair of pants that comes up to here and suspenders and a weird little hat, and he won't hold hands. And I'm thinking, what's wrong with this guy? There's a guy named Dave Ace there that night, 31 years of sobriety. There's a lady named Betty, beautiful lady with red hair, and she eventually wanted me to date her granddaughter. I mean, that's how well you can get in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hell of a deal, really is. Let me tell you about Doc, because I want to tell you, these people are my heroes. These are the men and women who saved my life. So I thought Doc was a little weird, and I didn't really know much about Doc. But let me tell you what happened is every day, Doc drove a taxi cab, and every day he'd drive down to central office, and he'd let Earlene go to lunch, and he'd sit in central office. He'd shut his meter off, and every day he gave an hour of his time to take care, to make sure the phone was answered at central office. And Earlene would come back, and Doc would get in his taxi cab and turn the meter back on and go back about his business. You know, you are what you are, so loud, I can't hear a word you're saying. It's by our actions. You know, I have learned how to act like a decent human being by watching you people. Father Ed Dowling, as some of you guys know, was Bill Wilson's spiritual sponsor. He was a little Jesuit priest. He came into Bill's life a few years after the fellowship started, and he was around us. And Father Ed, there's actually a book on Father Ed, and you guys, if you haven't read it, you should. Because Father Ed, a lot of our fellowship is based on him. And one of the things, he was sitting in Cleveland in 1960 with a man named Chuck C., and they were sitting across from each other, and the little Jesuit priest looked at him and he said, "I want you to know that your cross to bear was alcoholism." He said, "But mine was lack of faith. I went through the entire Jesuit order. I was ordained a priest and I didn't believe a damn thing." He said, "I came to believe by watching what happens to you people in this fellowship." That's a profound statement. I can make that statement tonight and I have no trouble with it, because that's what's happened in my life. Men and women have come into my life and have given me that little juice that you get here. That little turn on the fire under the water heater, and they've given it to me over and over and over again. When I've been at my lowest point, men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous have come and said, do this way. So I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm 25 years old and I haven't got a clue. But I was told what to do, go to a meeting every night and don't drink in between meetings. I go to a meeting at the Haven, which was to become my first home group, and a lady named Susan spoke that night. She was the wife of a senator. She had been sober 7 years, and I had nothing in common with her other than the fact that she drank poorly. And Alcoholics Anonymous had unaccountably transformed her life. I love that word, unaccountably transformed. How do you get from there to here? You can't. I spent my 21st birthday locked up in Nashville City Jail. That was my woohoo. That's as good as it got for me. You know, I just went out to have a little fun. And that was the story of my life. I just wanted to have a little fun. I wanted to ease a little of the pressure. I wanted to get a little of the heat off. And I didn't know and didn't care how many men and women I hurt along the way, how many cars I wrecked, my parents. You know, I look back, a little history. I am one of 8 children. But the strange part about that was I was given up for adoption. Now, I'm not the first and I'm not the last. I was the third. Nobody gives up the third child. My drunken mother did. Good for her. She had 2 children by the time she was 18 years old. She met my father, who was married to somebody else. She got pregnant and ended up in a unwed mother's home in Buffalo, New York. My grandparents said, "You can't keep the baby." And I got given away. I was put in foster care for about 11 months and given away to Ozzie and Harriet Nelson-like people. And if you don't know who Ozzie and Harriet Nelson is, you're talking about Father Knows Best. You're talking about normal human beings. And if you remember the movie Gremlins, they didn't know what they were not given instructions about not putting alcohol in their son's body. And that's what happened. I'm a little short, fat kid till I'm 15 years old. I don't know how to do it any different. So I just decide one day I don't want to be a little short, fat kid anymore. And I lose the weight and I discover drugs and alcohol and away we go. And my parents had no idea that this thunderstorm, this tornado had come into their life. And they would try to talk to me rationally and they tried to talk to me with practicality. And I'm thinking to myself, I just want to get drunk. And that's the bottom line I've discovered about alcohol is I like getting drunk. I don't like drinking a little bit. I like getting drunk, taking off my clothes, running naked, and barking at the moon. I mean, that's the kind of drinking I like to do. And there is no illusion whatsoever that I want to do it any different than that. That's how I want to drink. And I want to do that every day. And if you lock me up in jail when you let me out, that's what I want to do. I want to go do it again. And if I wreck the car, I want to do it again. Whatever happens, it doesn't matter. I'm going to get up the next day and get drunk like that all over again. So anyway, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous now. I'm sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd like to be different. And so I go to a bunch of meetings and I get a sponsor. And my sponsor's name's Warren Stack. And Warren won't give me his phone number. Some of you guys may have sponsors that are real kind and loving and caring. I hear these stories about sponsors. Warren wouldn't give me his phone number. He says, "You're a flake, you probably won't be here." I tell you what, you want to talk to me, come down to the Alano Club and wait. I go to the Alano Club 2-3 times a day. You come down and sit at the Alano Club and wait till I get there. And I thought, well, that's pretty crappy. Yeah, really? Everybody else has these sponsor stories. I'm thinking taking me fishing, you know. I'm thinking scuba diving. Maybe he'll get me a job. Maybe he'll let me date his granddaughter. I mean, something, right? Now, you can't have my phone number and come down and wait. And the magic of that was, because I didn't know anything else to do, I'd go down and I'd sit at the Alano Club. And I would sit down there and I would talk to men and women in the Alano Club. And a large part of my conversation was telling them what a crappy deal I had with the sponsor and how I was being abused and treated badly. And then after about 3 months, Warren gave me his phone number and we had rules. You can't call me after 9 o'clock at night. I have a job. You have to have a group of crazy people that you can call. Get phone numbers from people who are new in sobriety. That's who you call after 9 o'clock. He says, you also can't call me till 9 in the morning. He says, you need to rely on the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that you're going to build these relationships with. I don't want to build no relationship with anybody, right? I don't want to do that. I maybe want to sleep with you, but I don't want a relationship. And so I didn't understand some of this stuff. And after about 3 months, he gives me the phone number, and I call him once or twice, and then he up and dies on me. And I think, Jesus, I got shortchanged. So I, because I've gotten a home group, I'm going to the Haven. And the Haven is a men and women's recovery house in Salt Lake City that was started by three women. And one of them's name's Pat. And Pat becomes my sponsor. She was probably the only woman in Salt Lake City in AA that was safe from my advances at that time. I was young and adorable and cute and had no frontal lobe development. And I mean, it just, I was just a mess. But Pat was old enough, and I thought, okay. So Pat had me come to these meetings. And on Friday nights, I go to a 12 and 12 meeting, and on Tuesday night, there's a speaker meeting, and my home group then would give away these two little gold AAs. And so you stay sober for a year to get two gold AAs from OC Tanners. And I couldn't wait. I knew as soon as I got a year of sobriety, everything was going to be different. I got up. I was going to tell everybody about it. They gave me the little gold pins. And you know what? I woke up the next morning, and I was still me. Nothing different. And I was to find that to be true at 5 years, at 10 years, at 25. I just took a 42-year chip, and at 40, I thought maybe, nah, nothing. I still wake up being me the next day. You have to have a rearview mirror to see the distance, to see how far I've come, and to find out that you can't get there from here. You have to have the distance. And so you have to stay here. And so I guess if nothing else, I'd like to tell you how I got to stay. So I'm about 8 months sober, and I can't do the four step. I just can't. I got an inch and a quarter of paper telling me how to do the four step. But because you guys had told me to go to a 12 and 12 study every week, and my home group at that time, we would have a big meeting. We would read the 12 and 12, and then we'd break up into four or five little groups. And I'm in a meeting one night, and a guy says, you know, some of you guys are having trouble with the four step. He says, let me make it easy on you. He says, you get a piece of paper, you draw, you put numbers down the left side. He said, you draw two lines down the paper, you put, I'm resentful at causes and effects. And he said, how many of you people in this room don't know who you'd like to run over with a car? How many people in this room don't know who screwed you? And no hands, because we all know who's done it to us, how bad they've been to us all our lives. He said, go home and write about that. So I go home and I write all the people who have done me wrong. And I put the causes, makes me mad, almost all of them. Angry. I'm so angry, it just makes me angry even thinking about it. 42 years later, I just want to get even with them all, right? And it said effects. Now, I have no idea what it affects. I have no idea what I'm feeling. So I go to the big book, and it tells what those effects are. Mrs. Brown did this and that, and that. So I write those things in there. That's it. And now I got to take it to somebody and talk to them about it. Well, I don't know about that. I don't know. There's not a statute of limitations at that time that's gone away on a couple items. And there's a guy named Dave. And Dave just got out of prison, and I don't even like Dave. I don't like anything about him. But I'm thinking Dave is a little slipshod in his program. He's still doing some slimy stuff. I'm thinking Dave's going, he's going to violate his parole. He's going back to jail. I'm doing my fifth step with Dave. And he's going back to jail, and he can't tell anybody. So I go to Dave. And I said, hey, Dave, I got to tell you some stuff. So I tell him. Sure enough, Dave messes up in a few months, and back to prison he goes. See, so my plan works. So I'm hanging around AA, and I'm getting my one-year pin, and I'm beginning. This is when I asked you guys about this 5 to 15 years. So this is what's going to happen. Is this all there is? Is this it? This is what I got to do the rest of my life? I got to come to these meetings? I got to do this? You've got to be kidding. There has to be more. And at that time, I thought there was a secret organization in with AA, kind of like the Masons, where you have the little guys with the hats and the scooters. There's got to be a 33-degree. And if you just hang out in AA long enough, the really advanced AA people are going to note and come up to you and, like, you know, after a meeting, come up and, psst, psst, we got a special meeting only for people like you. Please come and join our advanced AA. So I kept waiting for it to happen. And I tried a lot of different things. I drove all over the state of Utah because I thought maybe they were isolated up in Logan or St. George or something. But nobody was coming up to me and telling me that I was special. And I really want to be special. So about 15 months into this, I'm now at 15 months and I haven't gotten through the eighth and the ninth step because I don't understand the eighth and the ninth step. It's beyond me. I read the six and the seven, but you guys know it's just a little short paragraphs, right? So you just read it. There, I'm done. Good. Okay. Move on. So I'm in a meeting at my home group. We're talking about step eight. And a guy answers the question for me. How do you do it? And he says, here's the deal. You put numbers on the left side. Does this sound familiar? You put numbers on the left side of the paper. And then on the right side, you write everybody you owe money to. I thought, well, okay. Then what do? You pay them back. I thought, wow, okay, I can do that. So I'm going to tell you, on a Friday night, I heard this news. On a Saturday, I went out and wrote the list. And on Saturday, I wrote four checks. I couldn't pay all of it to one of these doctors, so I made payments for about a year. And I sent out the money. I owed a phone bill for an old roommate, and I did some other stuff. There, I've done my eighth and my ninth step. I go to work on a Monday morning. I work at a ski resort. So this is the other thing, is God does for you what you can't do for yourself. I worked at Park City Ski Corporation for 5 years, and I was a lift electrician, lift mechanic. And so I would go to meetings, and people would whine about their jobs, or their this, or their that. And they'd ask, well, what was your day like? And I'd, well, I rode a snowmobile all day, or I skied all day, or I met Arnold Schwarzenegger and had lunch with him, or whatever it was. So the whining was eliminated, because I had this great job. And so all I could whine about was the people I had to work with. You know, those people who treat you badly, that raise their voice when you do something wrong. And at that time in my sobriety, I was doing a lot of things wrong. I couldn't keep my hands off other human beings. I was getting into fights at work. And I was having a difficulty with other human beings. And I didn't know what to do about it. But anyway, I come home from work and this is Monday, and I've had a terrible day. And I get home from work, and I'll tell you, at that time I had moved into Salt Lake City, and I lived in a little basement apartment I rented from a deaf lady. And if you're new in sobriety, rent from a deaf lady, because you can scream and yell and rail against the world, and she can't hear anything. And that's what I'd do. I'd come home, I'd be mad, I'd slam doors, I'd yell, I'd scream. My mother, on her deathbed, my wife and I were there when my mother was dying, and she shared with my wife that when I was a small child, my mother used to let me lay in the floor and kick till I was exhausted. So that's the coping mechanism I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the best I got going for me. And come to find out, I used it for a lot of years. I just exhaust myself, railing against the situation at hand. And then at some point, I don't know that it's a surrender as much as you just give up and think, fine, do it to me all over again. The universe has been screwing me. Just one more time, go ahead. And you go through that whole blah, 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 blah. You know, and eventually you tire of listening to yourself whine. You won't tolerate whining from anybody else, but you certainly eventually get over it from yourself. And that's what was happening for me. I was getting tired of this. But I come home from work, and I have a sink, and the sink doesn't, it drips. It just drips. And a little background on this. My first apprenticeship was as a pipe fitter, pipe welder at Ingalls Shipbuilding down in Pascagoula, Mississippi. I know a lot about pipes. I know a lot about welding. I know a lot about plumbing. And I had already fixed this sink twice. And it's not that hard. You take it apart. You got two little rubber things. You got a couple springs. Not rocket scientists, right? But it still leaked. So it must be a little more complex. So I got another repair kit. And I go out in the front yard, and I'm going to turn the water off. And this is where it gets a little technical. There's a valve called a wedge valve, and it's a quarter turn. Most water systems use them. And all you do is go out there, put a crescent wrench on it, and you turn it a quarter turn. Water shuts off. No big deal. Already knew how to do it. Already had done it a couple times. So I go out in my front yard, and I turn it a quarter turn. I go back in the house. I turn the water on. It runs, and it runs, and it runs, and it runs. I go back out in the front yard. I think, well, maybe I went the wrong way or something. I turn it another quarter turn. Nothing. Go back in the house. Runs, runs, runs. I don't know. I do this a couple times, and I come back in the house, and the damn water's still running. And I think to myself, I can't do the simplest thing. With all my training, with all my knowledge, and I can't even shut the damn water off. And that little thing, that whatever we come into recovery with that's holding us back, this little thing broke. And I laid down on the couch and I began to cry because I felt so pathetic that I couldn't do this simple task. So here's what happens. And I go, if somebody told us this story, I wouldn't believe it. But I'm telling it to you anyway. So I'm on the couch and the water stops. And I walk up to the sink and I get ready to put the sink back together the same way I've done it two other times. And a little voice, you know that little voice up here? And a little voice says, flip the little rubber things over. And the other little voice over here says, that doesn't make any sense. Look at the picture. Picture says to do it this way. This little voice says, but you've already done it that way twice and it's never fixed it. The little voice over here says, take a chance, do it. I flipped the little rubber things over. I put the sink back together. I went and sat on the couch, and honest to God, the water began to run. This can't happen. Physically, it's impossible. God moved into my life that day. Gee, I had just completed the first 9 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this thing happens in my life. You cannot convince me of the magic, that there isn't magic, pixie dust, or something that is in this program, because I lived through it. I lived through the working of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and something moved in my life. Something changed. Now, I'm going to tell you something that I've discovered over the years. There's a belief in God's good, but it's not good enough for people like us. There's a thing called a conscious awareness of the living presence. When I heard that the first time, a little man named Chuck C. talked about that. I heard him speak in Ogden, Utah, and that's what he talked about. He talked about this conscious awareness, a living presence. And I said, what's that? I knew what it was from my head to my heart, but how do you bring that about? I've read the literature, all our literature, over and over and over I've read it, and I'm firmly convinced that what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is to bring that about. I'm also firmly convinced that there's a lot little underlying stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous that a lot of times we don't talk about, we gloss over. Bill Wilson was big on emotional sobriety in his later years. He began to talk about that. He began to work with that. And again, now you're at 5 years and you're on your way to 15. How do you get there? How do you get past those rough spots? How do you get where you're not drinking, but you're still making a mess of your life? How do you get through that? I'll tell you a little quick story here. So some of you guys know that Bill Wilson wrote the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You also probably know that he wrote the 12 and 12. But here's the interesting part about it. Bill went into a depression in the mid-40s, and he began to work with his sponsor, Father Ed. And what Father Ed made him do while he was working through the steps is they kept notes. They took notes. For 3 years, Bill worked through the 12 steps. And in about 1948, Father Ed said, you need to write a book. You need to take these thoughts and you need to put them down in a book. And Bill said, no, I'm not going to do that. The people of AA hate me for taking money for having written the big book. He said, I won't do that. And Father Ed said, yeah, you will. And our 12 and 12 came from those writings. That's how we got it. The big book was written in the first 2 years of sobriety, but the 12 and 12 is about 15 years later. So if you're in trouble, 5 to 15 years, I would suggest to get into the 12 and 12 because it's about long-term sobriety and the issues you're going to run into. I'm going to tell you what happened for me is, and by the way, after Bill did that, just a little history here. We wouldn't have the traditions if Dr. Bob hadn't died. Dr. Bob did not like the traditions. He probably wouldn't have accepted them. And Bill and Bob never had a crossword from everything I've been taught in AA, and Bill would acquiesce. And so when Bob died, then Bill was able to get the traditions in place, and Bill was able to step down as the leader of Alcoholics Anonymous, and at that point's when his depression lifted. It's an interesting story. It's fascinating. You know, he may have been the guy that started Alcoholics Anonymous, but he was still one of us, and he suffered from humanness, and he suffered from the frailties, and he suffered from unknowns, and he was just as scared and frightened as us. Anyway, I love history. I love the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you go to a convention, always go to the archivist and ask him some of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous because it's fascinating. It really, truly is. We have a rich history. There's a lot of books. If you're new and you are having trouble sleeping at night, get some of our literature. Put you to sleep just that fast. There's a book on Sister Ignatius. And if you wonder about those coins, where we get it, we got it from a little Catholic nun. Gave it to us. Isn't that interesting? You know, if you asked a non-alcoholic to talk at an AA meeting now, you'd be hung. And yet in the old days, we used to let people come in and talk. I've been privileged since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to meet some people. I tell you, I believe in going to conferences. My first conference I went to was Fish Lake, and it was up in Utah in August or so, and I got up there, and I'll tell you two things that happened there. So the first thing is it's Saturday morning, and I wake up, and I haven't got a friend in the world. I'm 7 or 8 months sober, and I don't have anybody in my corner. And there's a campground or a campsite right next to mine, and there's a man named Kent F., and he's over in that campground, and he walks over, and he introduces himself. And what he did is he opened up his life and he allowed me in. And for the next 4 years, whenever he and his wife, Eddie, and their two kids went camping, or they did something or had an event to go to, I got dragged along. I got adopted by Kent. And I look back on that and I think, how lucky. How lucky can you be to have somebody you don't even know to walk into your campsite and walk into your life and save your life? And I think to myself, my God, I could have missed it. I could have missed all of this stuff. But I want to tell you, that afternoon, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I go out to have lunch. And there's a beautiful redhead, older woman sitting there eating lunch. So I slither on up to her thinking, maybe she's single. You know, I'm single. We're in a campground. Maybe this will be pretty cool. Anyway, we get to talking and she tells me she's the Al-Anon speaker that night. And I like, oh, okay. And then she tells me that her husband's the main speaker that night. And Norm Alfie sits down next to me. And I had lunch with Norm and Betty. And that night, they talked. And I'll tell you what I took away from Norm, and I want to share this with you. He would say this, and he would say, not every day is a holiday, and not every meal is a banquet, but I've had a chance to walk on the sunny side of the sidewalk. And that's really what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. You know, I came in here, I was 25 years old, and I had no chance of a life. And I stayed here long enough, and over these years, you guys have taught me how to be a functioning human being. I went through some really tough times. I had some real hard times. But I want to tell you, up to about 22 years of sobriety, I was in charge. I was in complete charge of my life. I had managed financially to put my life somewhat together. Again, you can't get from there to where I got to without God moving in. I did a Tony Robbins Change Your Life thing in 28 days. I had some weird stuff that happened and over a couple strange phone calls. I tell this one story. So I sent out 260 resumes. I'm at Robinson Plant in North Carolina. I sent out 260 resumes and I don't hear one thing, not from one resume. I'm in Fort Worth, Texas, working in a Keebler factory. They don't have elves. It's a lie. There was a lot of large human beings working in this Keebler factory, but no elves. And I'm sitting in front of an electrical panel, and back then we all had pagers. And I'm sitting in front of the electrical panel, and I'm, I don't know, 10, 12 years sober. I can't remember how many years sober. And my life's over. I got this white powder that's falling on me because of the potato chips. It's a potato chip factory, and they make it out of powder. They don't even use real potatoes. And it's all over me, and I'm thinking, this is where sobriety's taking me. And my pager goes off. And it's a guy named Larry Standish, and he works out at Diablo Canyon, and he's looking for one INC tech with nuclear plant experience, and he wants me to come to work at Diablo Canyon and make more money than I've ever made in my life. But I asked him, how did you get my resume? Because I never sent him a resume. So here's how God works. His company got bought up by a company called Rust International. Rust International had gotten one of my resumes. He needed one more INC tech to come out here. He called to the company that had just bought him and said, have you got anybody? Moi. Poof. Next thing I know, I'm driving down the access road into Diablo Canyon. And I work there now. I've quit them and worked for them and quit them and worked for them. But my career, I'm about to retire in September and I'm finishing up my career. My last 5 years, I've worked out there. And how do you get there? You don't even have to send the resume to the right company. That's what I'm trying to tell you. You have to send the resume, but it doesn't even have to go to the right place, because if God wants you somewhere, he's going to move stuff around. And the next thing I know, I'm coming out here and I'm working and my life is changing and I'm thinking, okay, I got this. And that's the thing. 5 to 15 years. If you hear, you got to have friends to listen for this. When you hear somebody say, "I got this," slap them. Just slap them, because they don't. I want to tell you one quick story, and I want to share with you that what happened is I got out of my own way. At about 22 years sober, I was able to get out of my own way. I wish you could teach somebody how to get out of their own way, but the only way I learned it was by failing dismally over and over, making painful mistakes, doing things that resulted in what I considered were wrong decisions. Come to find out, it was what I needed to do to put me in the right place. I work at a nuke plant because in 1988 I burned my house down in Texas. I quit my job and I had no other choice but to go to Cooper Station up in Nebraska. 30 degrees below zero, my camper froze up, my transmission went out of my truck, and I could have, if you had asked me at that time, I'd have told you it was a bad deal. Now, 35 years later, I can tell you it was the first piece of the puzzle to put me in the position where I am right now. Get yourself some heroes. If you're new in here, get yourself some heroes. My hero, I got a hero that's 7 years sober, more sober than me. I just talked to him on Thursday night. He's 79 years old. He's 49 years sober. He's having a ball. He's my hero. He was my hero when I got here. When I grew up, I wanted to be like Jack. Now, still want to be like Jack. He's full of enthusiasm. He helps guys, he works with newcomers. But I want to tell you how you get a lot of this stuff is page 53 and 12 says the primary fact of my life is my inability to form true partnerships with another human being. Service is supposed to be inconvenient. If you haven't served on the board of directors for one of the Alano clubs or for one of the groups, or if you haven't served on central offices board or as a DCM, you haven't done it. Get involved. Get involved with Alcoholics Anonymous. Brian's looking for people to help him at the 4th of July. Get involved. The men and women you will meet doing service are the men and women you'll call at 3 in the morning. I guarantee you. And what will happen is that the change will occur because of these men. There's a woman named Myrtle Snyder, and I've never met Myrtle Snyder, but I will tell you what she told a man named Johnny H. a long time ago. And when I heard Johnny speak, he talks of this. So Myrtle was counseling Johnny when he first got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was whining, a bit like I whined. And he was asking about this Alcoholics Anonymous. What does God want out of this whole thing? This God thing. What does he want? You know, does he want me to, what? Because I grew up in the Episcopal Church, and we used to sing those awful songs and sad, and you weren't worthy enough to gather up the crumbs from under the table, and come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys tell me I gotta have a relationship with God. And I'm thinking, how the heck do you do that? Anyway, here's her little deal. She said, somebody's phone's up here, I just saw that. Anyway, she's talking and she says, God's gift to us is our sobriety. And what you do with your sobriety is your gift back to God. And here's the little prayer. Whenever I'm not doing real well, I think to myself, I hope my Father in heaven is as pleased with his gift to me as I am with his gift. I hope he is as pleased with my gift to him as he is, or I am as, you guys got it, right? You know, I'm going to end a couple minutes early because that makes everybody happy. Anyway, thank you guys.
Give our speaker another hand.